everybody. Welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. Remind you, I'm still Eric Rubenstein, Senior Director of Litigation, Fraud, Waste, Abuse Support, here at Advise, and with my two steady ship partners in crime, Wade McFall, retired Assistant Special Agent in Charge from the OIG's LA office, now a manager on our SIU team, and leading the helm, as always, Matt Kachansky, our Payment Integrity Director, Senior Payment Integrity Director, and the retired Northeast UPIC Director, and the retired Special Agent in Charge. You would think that you've got like seven or eight pensions going on, and that you're just working here to have something to do with your day. It's just kind of, you know, remarkable. But, you know, we'll get into your deep finances.
Yeah,
we'll get into your deep finances later, because I have a lot of questions. So today we want to talk, going back to some conversations vis-a-vis the SIU-related operational things. One thing that came to mind, we were talking about it before, and I've had some conversations along the way. Guns and two sets of books. Let's talk about guns. I know in the law enforcement side, consistency, experience, and limiting liability. We're going to talk about how those work with law enforcement. You know, every day that Wade and Matt and I and all of our brethren and sisters in law enforcement, local, state, federal, it doesn't matter, develop their own sort of process and cadence for carrying their firearm. And it's all relatively the same. You get up in the morning, you retrieve your firearm from wherever it is, you put it on your belt with your holster. Oftentimes then you will withdraw the firearm, pointing it to a safe distance, do what's called a press check, make sure the round is seated properly in the gun, make sure the magazine is seated properly, and then you place it back in the holster, and then you continue through your day. That's a process that creates consistency. Every day you know that when you leave the house, that firearm was the way it should have been when you left. You develop that consistency from having experience to remind yourself and have it become second nature. You know, during the day, I would find myself, and Wade and Matt, we would talk about this, you find yourself doing kind of an elbow hip check. Even though you feel the gun on your body, you still do this. Everybody I speak to in law enforcement does this. And that's from experience of doing it. And I can tell you, when I first retired and I stopped carrying a firearm on a regular and frequent basis, I still found myself doing it. It was kind of a Pavlovian reflex that you have to get rid of. And it also works to limit your liability. And I mean personal liability in the sense of, God forbid, in the law enforcement space, you have an instance where that gun must come out of the holster and it must go bang to protect yourself or others. You need to make sure that it goes bang. And this is, again, you know, one of those things where when you've got the consistency and the experience of doing that, you can at least work towards ensuring that you've got that. So consistency, experience, and limiting liability. But how does that transfer into the SIU space, right? So Wade, number one, you know, when we talk about limiting liability, so first of all, we see consistency as one of the main pillars, and we see experience and limiting liability as two stances on that pillar to support that main pillar of consistency. And the most important thing is that when you have consistency, you will develop experience, you will be able to limit your liability. And I think, you know, a lot of times what we're talking about is you don't want to be the guy or gal on the stand who has to provide an answer that has a level of inconsistency with other people that might also be on the stand, right? While cases have their own kind of nuance to them, certainly there are going to be things that are going to be consistent throughout the operation of the program that you're working on. And that does help to limit liability. And when we talk about limiting liability, we aren't inherently talking about limiting legal exposure. But to be honest with you, if anybody has ever had to be on the stand to testify, and I talk about this a lot because I've had a lot of cases that I've testified in at my OIG time, and I've testified a lot here in depositions of trials, you want to get on and off the stand. You want to get on quickly. You want to get off even faster. And you want to make sure that you're providing, obviously, truthful, consistent information. And it's not so much limiting the liability, meaning the exposure, but liability of having to sit on that stand and have to continue to talk and discuss things. So wait, consistency, experience, limiting liability, really strong foundations that we can tie back to a lot of things.
Right. And it definitely, I agree with everything you said, and it is a key to limiting liability. And one of the things, though, I think to back up a little bit is we need consistency in a bunch of different areas. Like we always talk about records requests, maybe due dates, timelines on interviews, those types of things. So they need to be consistent, but they also need to be based on like best practices, based on experience and standards. So you want to have, as we talked about many times, if you're going to routinely request medical records and you have a number, not just a random number you pull out of the air, but a thought out, evidence-based number, maybe it's 25 records, maybe it's 30, that's less important, the actual number, as much as it is that you be consistent and you always do 25, you always do 30, so that it doesn't get to a point where if someone's on the stand and they're asking, why did you do 25? It should be based on, again, real experience, standards, best practices. So you can say, we always do 25. It's a variation between getting the big picture and limiting provider abrasion. You can have a standard canned response, but as long as it's consistent, that's really the key. And same with like interviews. We've talked about this too. If you're talking about an interview you did the interview 10 days after you did the interview report 10 days after the interview. Your partner gets up and he did his 2 days after. There's obviously a benefit to doing it closer in proximity to the actual interview. You're not going to miss things. You're not going to misinterpret things. If that's another standard that you're using based on best practices, we always do our interviews within 5 working days and it's consistent across the board. It definitely limits your liability. And like you say, it gets you off the stand quicker.
Yeah, and it's a super key point. And I'm really glad actually that you brought up that intersection, documentation, the interviews. Consistency can really cut across a lot of things. We could talk about it even when we're talking about, so you talked a little bit about probe sampling, statistically valid random sampling. The entire premise of statistically valid random sampling is consistency. Methodology matters. And the way that you do these things really does matter. And I will tell you, and you guys know this, and for those of you who watch our podcast who have had the fortune or misfortune of having to testify in a hearing, a deposition, or whatever, it can become a will of, a mind will, right? How can you stay on the stand for 8 hours having the same question asked of you 100 times? And that's possible. It happens. In a deposition, it's typically, I think, 7 hours of actual Q&A time. So 7 hours. You can be in a deposition. That does not include the lunch break. That does not include stopping, going off the record, pauses, any of that. It's 7 hours of sitting, being asked questions, which could equate to an 8, 9, 10 hour day. I had a deposition recently. I was in the office of the lawyer that for the firm that we were doing work for. It was 10 hours. 7 hours of deposition time was a 10 hour day. Because we took a lunch break, we had off the record, we had different things like that. So, and that becomes a very long and exhausting day. So that consistency and that experience and that standardization works to help maybe cut that time down. If they want to keep you for 7 hours, they're keeping you for 7 hours. You can't do anything about it. But I would much rather be asked 7 hours of fresh questions than be grilled for an hour about why did I write this interview report up a week and a half after, I did the interview. And Matt, it then gets onto that other piece because when we're talking about consistency, experience, and limiting liability, we're also talking about a single source of truth coupled with completeness and accuracy. And when you have a single source of truth, it lets you tie things back. When we talk about, for example, in medical record reviews, we're talking about a single source of truth. What is the policy that was being followed as our source of truth? What is the underlying document that we went to? And the biggest thing, and we find this pretty often, is that SIUs who spend an inordinately high amount of money in their budget for tools. Whatever that tool is, it could be a data tool, a case manager, it could be a hybrid, it could be a prepaid tool, a postpaid tool, anything along those lines. A tool is only as good as the user of that tool. A hammer on the desk is a paperweight, but a hammer in a carpenter's hand is like a paintbrush to Picasso, right? And so the important piece is a single source of truth. If you have a tool and you aren't conversant in how to fully use that tool, and then take shortcuts by using other things, you lose that single source of information. And then, therefore, you have, as they love to say in the movie Casino, two sets of books.
Yeah, let's let's bring it back even to a smaller level. Let's go back to Wade's interview. You know, you've got a consistent way to conduct the interview, which is someone asking questions, someone taking notes, and someone writing the report. Usually the person taking the notes writes the report a consistent way. What you don't want is both of those people writing separate reports, because you've got two sets of books at that point, and it causes problems because they're never going to mirror each other. There's going to be differences that will be pointed out when you're in that deposition or you're on the stand, and it will cause you exposure to liability. And so one set of books there. Now let's broaden that to the tools. You know, you've got a wonderful case management tool that tracks everything, that you put your dates in, you put your case notes in there and things like that. But because it's a little difficult or you don't understand it, you put your documentation, your interview reports, your subpoenas, your affidavits, whatever they may be, you put them in a different place. And you might, you know, you might attach something to them. You might have the interview report and the notes there. You reference it in the case management system, but you've got two sets of books. It never works. There's always going to be differences. There's always going to be discrepancies. You might forget to put it in the one place and not the other. Right. And it just, we went through this in the UPIC, you know, with the case management system, where we had a new one, a centralized one, but because there were some flaws in it, we were asked to keep two sets of books, and our findings at the end of the year were always, there were notes in one and not in the other, or missed or dates that were wrong and things like that. It never reconciles, and it leads you to exposure and a lack of credibility in your investigative findings. You know, so consistency helps with that. Right. When you do the same thing over and over again, lends credibility.
Right.
So does having one set of books that you can rely on 100%.
You know, and the issue is that as something as simple as a period missing from one document versus another, or a document missing, at the end of the day, the question will become, which set is the right set? Well, the answer is neither, because how do you know which is the right set? If you have a tool that you're spending a lot of money on, and for the SIU in the payment integrity space, return on investment is part and parcel to the operational piece of payment integrity SIU management. ROI is also predicated upon getting those dollars back versus expenditures. If you're out there spending hundreds and thousands of dollars or more, because we've seen some of these tools hitting seven figures, if you're spending hundreds of thousands of dollars or more on a tool that's supposed to be your data analytics tool, your case manager tool, and you're not using it to its fullest extent, you're basically paying for nothing. You're paying for a tool that you're not using. If you're using 10% of it, you should only be paying 10%, either limit the access, whatever. The other piece that I'd also say is, if you're starting to use that tool and you're finding that it's not doing what you really need it to do, then, and as a result, you start doing things offline to make up that difference. That's the time that you have to have a conversation with your data analytic case manager vendor. Because if you're paying for something and they're not able to produce it in a manner that's for you, or it doesn't track what you need it to track, there's a conversation that needs to be had. Is what you need to be done something that's hard-coded, meaning it's across the entire enterprise of the tool, or is it soft-coded, means that it can be developed for each client? And the important piece of that is, you want tools that are more soft-coded than hard-coded, because the more hard-coding it is, the less wiggle room that the tool has to be able to give you the customization that you need, particularly if you are working where you have reports that need to go out across different lines of businesses, different states, things of that sort. So, you know, that consistency, it stretches from the investigative piece. It connects itself back to the way that you're going to track your cases, all of that. And honestly, when you become more experienced at doing these things, these are lessons that you learn along the way. You're not looking to have someone who's, you know, a one-year investigator understand all of these things. Similarly, when you're in a position of management leadership authority in the SIU space, these are things that you have to start thinking of. And those things come about from experience, and they come from relying upon people within your core team who have that experience to be able to kind of share that. I mean, we're starting to see that there are a ton of these data analytics tools out there. And while they all have some value of some sort, we're finding that oftentimes we're learning that SIUs aren't using these tools to the extent that they could be or should be, because they either don't know how to use it, or the human-centered design, or HCD, is so cumbersome that you know, to click 7 or 8 or 9 times to get to where you need, you just say, forget it, this isn't worth it. Because if you make one wrong click, you're going to be somewhere else, or the thing is buried somewhere. I mean, how many times do we go up on websites where we need to do something and you cannot find it? You get up on a chat, right, with the company, and they tell you, oh, navigate to this. And you're like, that's in the place that it's of the least places where it should be. This form is located here, but it has nothing to do with where here is. And that's part of where that conversation has to exist. So consistency, experience, and limiting liability. Matt, I want to give you the last word on this, because this is something that we have been identifying to our kind of shock. This is more prevalent than we ever really thought. What has to happen?
What has to happen is SIUs need to get, you know, to work within themselves to come up with set policies and procedures where they create workflows, create work instructions where everything that they do is consistent. In terms of the tools that they use, they need to understand what resources they have to put into the tool, and then what do they need to get out of that tool, and only try to invest in that. If they try to get, you know, spend a lot of money because they think they're going to get more bells and whistles, but they don't have the resources to do it, it's a waste of money. You've got to really tailor your tools to your needs. So like the carpenter with the hammer, he only needs a hammer. He doesn't need the sledgehammer because he doesn't do demo. So don't have it.
And, you know, it's interesting you say that because, you know, we've been speaking to a couple of plans about some of their needs, and a few of them have actually come to us and said, these case management tools and these data analytics tools have so many features we don't need that we're paying for. We have one plan that we're bringing on board soon where they're looking for 1 to 2 leads a month, and then some months no leads. And their fear is that if they go to any of the big vendors out there for data, they're going to be getting 5 leads for every month without fail. And then their leadership is going to say, well, what have you done with these 60 cases? They have one SIU investigator, one. And that investigator is maxed out right now. So, you know, what do you do? So it is a challenge, and it really is. It's consistency, experience, and limiting that liability to the things that you have that control over. So, and no two sets of books. And, you know, as they said in Casino, make sure that the number of blueberries is consistent between the muffins.
Yep. You know, you get whacked, you can skim off the top.
You don't want to skim off the top, exactly that. So good stuff, guys. We appreciate it. So, you know, we got a lot of things coming up. We got a bunch more LinkedIn Lives in the hopper. Dan Olson and I, at the end of the month, will be doing part 2 of our LinkedIn Live discussion on data. We're going to talk about the life cycle of a claim that's submitted. And then we're going to talk about data modeling. And we're going to talk about the importance of why investigators really shouldn't understand fully what the life cycle of a claim is, including the nuances of things like document control numbers and things of that sort. Why is that important? Well, tune in at the end of the month and you'll learn when Dan and I do our LinkedIn Live at the end of September. We're going to talk about that. And as always, you can catch us on our weekly newsletter on Fridays. Comes right to your inbox on our YouTube channel. Just go into YouTube, look for Advice Health, subscribe to our YouTube channel, get you pre-recordings, the past recordings, rather, of the LinkedIn Lives and our weekly OIG roundtables here. And we continue to enjoy seeing everybody at the conferences. And of course, we've got NAMPI coming up in November. I'm sorry, NHCA in November. We just had NAMPI last week for 2 weeks ago. So for those of you that got to see Dan Olson and Jean Marie, I know that I just talked to both of them yesterday, and they really just talked about how great it was seeing all the people within the community. And we are looking forward in November to stopping in and seeing everybody over at the NHCAA. So if you're there, come find us. We might have a t-shirt or two around to throw. Jean Marie is talking about wanting to get a t-shirt gun, but I think she thinks that she's at the 50-yard line at Giants Stadium and shooting off. I've told her that you are not limiting your liability by having a t-shirt gun. What you are probably doing is sending a lot of people to the hospital, particularly after you hit one or two in the chest and you giggle over it. That's going to become a problem. So we hope to see you at NHCA. Maybe we'll have some goodies. And until we see you the next time, have a good one. We'll see you on the next OIG Roundtable.
Thank you.
Thank you all.